Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
No way, Jose.
The following footage proves beyond any doubt that the tanks intentionally set the house on fire. It proves that the Branch Davidians were murdered. You can see that this tank has a gas jet on the front that shoots fire. You can also see the fire quite plainly. The tank goes into the house twice, and each time as it backs out, the fire at the gas jets is plainly visible.
We must all do more to recognize and look for the early warning signals that deeply troubled young people send.
Hey guys, it's Jose. You're watching No Way Jose. You can find us on YouTube, all the major podcatchers, and Rumble as well. Today I'm being joined by Igor Sarsky. I had him on a while back. We covered the smiley face killings, just kind of a general coverage of that topic. So I recommend you guys go back and check that if you haven't seen that. I'll be making a playlist now because I plan on doing more of these. As you can see by the title, this is called the Illinois Cluster. So there are multiple clusters with this, which we will be digging into progressively over time. You guys really dug the last one, so we're back. I also enjoyed it too. So we're back to it. I do want to, before we get into it, let you guys know that today's episode is brought to you by Nadeau Shave Co. If you're tired of that razor burn, irritation, and ingrown hairs you get from those deep penetrating multi-blade cartridges, then you need to get Nadeau. Big Shave has been psyoping the American people for decades with their expensive multi-blade razor scam. Go back to the traditional shave. It's better. It's cheaper. You don't need the expensive nonsense. This is high quality stuff. You can shave like your grandpa used to. It's a slick looking design. And whether you're just trying to do your whole face or edging up your beard, the single blades are the way to go. And it's a fraction of the price. So upgrade your shaving system. The standard issue includes one traditional safety razor and a box of 100 stainless steel razor blades. $75 is what it'll get you to do for shave for an entire year. That's estimated. You can make these things last depending on how often you shave. Now, if you're someone who shaves on the regular, you might want to consider the Quarter Shave Club, which is only 25 cents per replacement blade. They also has shave lather and soap and other stuff coming along. Actually, he has it out now. So go check that out. I'm waiting for my shave soap to come here soon, so I'll let you know how that is when it comes. But use Jose at checkout to get 10% off your order. Remember, these guys, if you want to support me and you want to get something out of it, this is the way to go, because they support me, and so by you supporting them, they support me. And also, this is a COVID mandate refusing company. This company was born out of rejecting the COVID mandate. He actually was in the military, on the dough, and he got booted out for refusing the mandate, and he had to do some entrepreneurial stuff, and here we are. It's a good product, and a good guy, good company. Highly recommend you check it out. But with that, guys, let's get into it. Let's get Igor in here. What's up, my man? How you doing?
Hey, Jose. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. It's happy to have you back. It's been a while. I got busy. I knew I wanted to come back to it eventually, and here we are.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it, and I enjoyed our last chat, and I think we actually connected because I heard you speaking on these cases, and it kind of interests me, your thoughts on these cases and what your perspective was. So we kind of got in touch that way.
Yeah, no, we definitely connected on that level, and that's why you're back. So I asked you, because we had talked about this before, about like maybe starting to break down cluster by cluster, and I figured maybe you want to go chronologically with it. But no, we're going a different one. What is this, 2005 to 2012 is this cluster, I believe. There are ones, you know, prior to that, obviously you have a better, you know, grip of the knowledge of that, what other groupings we have. But I guess, maybe to start, if you want to get into what your reasoning is for why you think this may be the way to go, the best way to roll out the carpet for our audience to understand these killings. I'm just kind of curious your reasoning.
Yeah, I think geographical clusters is a logical way to start. There's so many cases, and whether or not any of them connect and are applicable to each other is unknown. So the best way to approach it when you're kind of overloaded with data is to focus geographically. So I think that's probably why I would tackle it in that regard, rather as opposed to chronologically.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I just meant as opposed, because obviously the clusters are going to be in different times. So I'm just wondering what specifically about the Illinois. I mean, if you want to keep that close to the chest and we can come back to it, maybe, I don't know if you're trying to, spread that on us later. That's up to you.
The clusters, I mean, have been occurring in this phenomenon, since the late 90s and are still occurring today, depending on, you know, what case you adhere to, and you know, in terms of what case you believe are connected, they might still be happening today. I would say that the phenomenon itself is probably best described for your viewers as the instance where a young man is leaving a bar, club, or party at an odd hour of the night and goes missing completely with no evidence whatsoever as to where they might have gone. A good 15% of the caseload results in the victim or the individual never being found again. And about 85 to 80%, give or take, of the caseload involves the victim being found dead in water. Mm-hmm. So there's been a history of these cases, and you could potentially go back in time and start chronologically seeing when they started. The earliest clusters, I believe, are in Michigan and Wisconsin. So that could be done. And there's been a lot of research on those clusters, which is partially the reason why we're kind of deviating a little bit and going to the Illinois cluster. Okay. Partially.
I gotcha. You don't want to cover ground that's already been covered a ton, at least not right off the bat. You got to be a little bit hipster, a little niche. I get it. You know, you got to do something a little unique. But I guess, I think we talked about this a lot last episode. And so we did kind of cover a lot of the stuff we're going to kind of begin with here. But you wanted to kind of talk about the profiles that were developed by, you know, the assortment of researchers out there. And I think that we probably delved a little bit into the researchers and their profiles last time, but it'd probably be good to revisit it and maybe a little bit more in depth, to kind of pay, kind of like when I talk about Oklahoma City, especially, when I'm starting out, I usually give people resources of like, I mean, I know we're not specifically doing that, but to reference these different researchers, kind of pay homage to the people who came before, and also just give people a better idea of if they want to dig into certain people's work to get an idea if they really want to go down the rabbit hole. So I think that probably, as you actually said, this would probably be the best place to start. So I guess we're not technically really getting into Illinois cluster right off the bat, but we will. And as I said before, this the Illinois cluster is about 9 deaths in the course of from 2005 to 2012. For those who are are interested, and yeah, I know we're about to get in the profile, but it does seem to be always these people that evoke Pax Americana, like that kind of vibe. And it almost seems to, I know from our previous conversation, it almost seems like it shifts with the time too, like whatever the time would consider your Pax Americana. But we'll get into that. I'll pass it back to you and we can get into that.
Yeah, I see where you're going with that. I think that what's important for the viewers is that the original researchers were some fellows by the name of Gannon, Gilbertson, and Duarte, three different guys. Gannon and Duarte were ex-New York cops, transitioned into doing this kind of as private investigators, whereas Gilbertson's a criminologist professor out of Minnesota, I believe. So these guys aren't laymen's for lack of a better word, and they originally started representing some of the families who were vocal about there being connections with some of the earlier cases, specifically out of New York. They conducted their own private investigation. This is back in 1995 to about 2010, 2012, I believe, is the span of their investigation. They're still working on it now, but that's the core of when their investigation happened. And they actually wrote a textbook titled Case Studies in Drowning Forensics, pertaining to these cases, which is what I'm going to, draw upon today. The reason why I think it's important to talk about the profiles that exist out there is because I believe the profiles all point to the same area. So, I mean, we have Gannon and Gilbertson's profile. We have Murphy's profile. We have my profile that I developed while working with Ramsey. And all of the profiles have the same conclusions. So from my perspective, I like starting and showing where all the profiles kind of lead together, and then why the Illinois cluster is so interesting to me as it relates to that profile that these people have developed, including myself. Yeah.
All right, cool. Well, I guess we can get into it.
Let's start with Gannon and Gilbertson's textbook. So as I said, they published a textbook on these drownings around 2014. They've kept their investigation extremely tight-lipped. However, we do have some clues from their textbook as to where their profile is pointing towards. And obviously there's other reasons why I believe that they're pointing towards this certain area, which, I mean, I can't obviously speak about online. I can only talk about what's in the public domain, which is their textbook. So we can get into that. I pulled basically some interesting stuff from their textbook, from Murphy's profile, and from my own profile, kind of which, illustrate how close everyone is, I would say. So from Gannon and Gilbertson, the first thing that caught me is where they said that these cases are not the work of one killer, and they are not serial. These are not the work of a serial killer, and therefore they do not neatly fit into the profile of a serial killer. And the reason why that caught my attention is because Murphy had something extremely similar in his profile, alluding to the fact that in Murphy's profile, I believe he says that the level of competence, tight operational security, and seeming occult leaning suggested by the choice of victims lead me to believe that these are absolutely not serial killers of the variety that we are familiar. So both Murphy and Gannon and Gilbertson are illustrating in their profile that they don't believe they're actually looking for a serial killer per se. And you'll understand that they're looking more for somebody who's a terrorist, essentially, somebody who's committing terrorist acts, which is essentially what these cases are when you boil them down. They're domestic terrorism, which is what I believe the term Gannon and Gilbertson use for it is domestic terrorism.
Yeah, that would make sense. So we covered Gannon's and Gilbertson. I guess maybe, if you want to go a different route, let me know. But I guess it makes sense to go into Murphy's and how, I guess maybe how they're the same and how they're different.
That's the first element that's similar between the two profiles is the fact that they both admit openly that they're not actually looking for a serial killer. They don't actually believe that the profile is of a serial killer, rather something else that's not of the garden variety serial killer, which I think is dead on, and it's a commonality between the two. One interesting thing that caught me from Gannon's profile is that they believe that the killers, and this is an observational thing, that they operate in cell structures, which, I mean, anybody who looks at the cases can understand how they exhibit the nature, the cell structure nature, and the kind of leaderless resistance, kind of lone wolf type of ethos within the killings. And they actually use the term the most dangerous homegrown terrorist organization operating within the United States. So keep in mind, we don't know who they're talking about. We don't know who they're evidence, because they claim to have a lot of evidence that point towards one specific area, one specific grouping of individuals. They can't release it because they're real cops. I mean, they're doing an investigation, and you know how real cops are when they do investigations. If they have anything, they keep it close to the vest and they do more research on it and they try and flesh it out. So we just know what they're insinuating. And I think from your viewers, when they hear the words most dangerous homegrown terrorist organization operating in the United States, it probably starts to ring a couple bells in terms of who potentially they might have.
Yeah. There's a lot of different names for these entities. If you, for example, what's her name? Whitney Webb, like, uses the Enterprise in her book. But yes, I mean, my audience is very familiar with these dark groups, and maybe or Gladio, or different things that you can maybe apply to it in some sort of way. But yeah, it does seem like some sort of initiation or something along those lines to something darker. And now what? Obviously, we don't know. There's a veil between us and that, and that's kind of what we're picking at here. I guess, so we haven't really covered your profile yet. So I guess if you want, we can get into yours. We can go into a little bit of reasoning and then evaluate the specific cluster itself. But go on.
Yeah, I want to get there eventually. I think it's interesting to note, I have a couple more things on Gannon's profile.
Okay.
And then I want to do Gannon's profile, Murphy's profile mostly. And we will talk about where my research leads and stuff like that. Another interesting part from Gannon's profile that I want to kind of highlight for your viewers is that he says the group is intent on violence and they're at war with anyone who does not subscribe to their ideology. They are a group of equal opportunity killers whose belief system fuels behaviors that are becoming more and more violent with each passing day. They continue to work in semi-autonomous cells, not affiliated with any public known organization. So people will understand how that works with the lone wolves, right? They're consciously avoiding public organizations because that's how they avoid capture, right? They avoid the infiltration by not being involved with the above ground groups. While encouraging independent operatives for more dramatic effects, we believe they will play a major role in our next domestic terror threat. We only hope that it does not take the blowing up of another federal building like in Oklahoma City for this country, specifically the FBI, to get involved. So they are essentially, can't tell us where their information leads, but they're trying to smack us on the face. And I don't think people have kind of appreciated that they are really hinting here, trying to tell the public what they believe their profile is.
Yep. It yeah. reminds me a lot of, it just sounds exactly like describing 09A or something along those lines. I mean, not necessarily exactly
where,
that.
Which is
but...
where my research obviously you know, yes. led, started with.
Yeah. Yeah,
so they go on. It's extremely important to note that although the theosophy held by cell members may reflect that of specific larger or more well-known organizations, we do not claim that those more formal groups as organizations are responsible for these murders. So Murphy says this exact same thing in his profile, that there has to be a two-tier belief system. One that is, and this is how Murphy describes it, one that's more public consumption, more you know, mundane, right, for people who, you know, to take in, like, you know, the people marching in the streets, you know, and then one is more underground guerrilla faction type, like, you know, terrorist activity. And both Gannon and Murphy describe this two-tier system as it relates to whatever theosophy or ideology the killers subscribe to, which I thought was quite interesting. Because don't forget, I mean, they're completely different profiles, right?
Yeah.
So essentially his thesis is that, the thesis with that is that there's like a more public arm of the organization and a more like hidden underground arm, which is for very few people, very low consumption, but for more extremist types.
Yeah, which is kind of what I was alluding to, because I mean, my audience is very familiar with things like O9A and understand that it seems to have connections to things like 764 and other groups, and or it's a, you know, the feds describe it as things like accelerationism, where they are kind of almost pushing other groups to do things. So it does seem like this two-tier thing, like there's this belief system here, but then they push other belief systems in other areas. So I get kind of what you're getting at with a two-tier. Or though you could also look at it from like an O9 belief system as the initiated and the uninitiated. So I guess it depends on how you're looking at it, I guess. But go on.
Yeah, we can chat about the O9A a bit. I mean, just to spoil it for your viewers, basically the paragons of the profile would be basically David Myatt, James Mason, Pierce, Tomasi, Beam, Metzger. Like guys who are really focusing on autonomous cells doing untraceable small acts of violence to destabilize society, which is essentially, I don't know if you've read, if you know too much about Pierce, you know, his most famous book is Turner Diaries, obviously.
Oh, yep.
Yeah, a little lesser known book of his is called Hunter, which was actually found with Timothy McVeigh when he was captured. And the interesting thing about Hunter is I think it comports exactly with these cases, literally like to a T. In Hunter, they're describing how they avoid detection and destabilize society through like small autonomous acts of violence that are untraceable. And essentially, in a nutshell, that's how I view these cases, these smiley face killer cases, the epitome of small untraceable acts of violence, which have destabilizing effects for society. Quite frankly. So just a spoiler for your viewers, but because I want to chat about the O9A. I mean, I like chatting with the O9A, and I think that it's interesting as it relates to this profile, because the profile that, you know, Gannon, Murphy, and myself have all kind of arrived at different kind of different angles. We've all arrived at the same place. Mm-hmm. Most people probably know me from the videos I did with Ramsey. We did probably like 5 to 7 videos regarding the O9A and also Adam Woffen and Mason. I mean, I won't go over what we talked about in those videos, but I will say that originally I didn't know what to make of the O9A when I was reading it, because I saw some interesting clues in there, which gave me the impression that the people who were designing the O9A knew about these cases. And there were some pretty damning clues. I mean, they had to be, because obviously those videos were extremely popular. Ramsey himself said the first one was one of his most watched videos. People didn't take to that, and I get messages on that like weekly, and people didn't take to that so strongly because there was nothing there. There were some weird coincidences that we discovered in those videos. And I personally at the time didn't know what to make of it, because I didn't know if the O9A was real or not, whether there was really adherence, whether anything was bullshit, whether any of these paragons like Chloe Stevens or Sutter were you know, real or not, or were authentic or not. I didn't know any of that. So I was analyzing the O9A artwork and literature and zines from basically just, you know, a straight layman's perspective, where I didn't want anything out of it.
Yeah, I watched most of those, and I know what you mean.
Oh, it was, you did. Nice.
I think so, because was starting to cover 764 and O9A, because it was like kind of breaking stuff was going on at that time, and that's why I was covering it. I was like doing live streams and everything because it was like on the ground stuff and where. I to kind of get a deeper understanding, I went to Ramsey's because he's wrote a book on it, and just basically typed O9A and or different, you know, keywords in the thing to find his podcast that had covered that. And so I covered a bunch of it. So it was cool. You definitely were coming from an analytical mindset, and it was interesting. Then, you know, Ramsey, having studied them, you know, kind of their philosophy and stuff like that, would be like, oh yeah, you know, they believe this, and you kind of be like, oh shit. So, and you could kind of feel you were that it was kind of an interesting transformation to see. But I mean, even then, like, it is, we do juxtapose this talk with 09A, but I mean, I don't know, I don't necessarily know for sure, but at the very least, it's good to use that as an example of something along those lines, like some sort of weird group, shadowy group that requires some sort of initiation of some sort, which they even do in their philosophy. A lot of people say it's a LARP or some shit, but hey, it's there. And it's kind of this idea of like, hey, once you go to this next level, then you find out more and there's nothing public about what's more. So, and you have to do this culling thing. So, I mean, I don't know, you can say it's a LARP, but
let's talk about this. So interesting. So I have some good research on the ONA that a lot of people would only dream of. And I'm not even saying that to toot my own horn. I'm quite proud of my ONA research. One of the most interesting things I found while doing the research is that Myatt didn't actually create the culling doctrine. He stole it from a guy named Ben Clausen, who is the originator of creativity. And people may know creativity from Matt Hale in the early 2000s. It was one of the largest kind of like neo-Nazi white supremacist groups in the country. So Ben Clausen was very popular in the movement back in the 60s and 70s. And he wrote a whole bunch of stuff about culling as it relates to negative eugenics and white purity. Myatt just like Myatt robbed, because Myatt also, basically William Pierce was super into Savitri Devi. Myatt robbed a whole bunch of, you know, stuff from him, basically just because he was interested in it. Then he put a whole bunch of Savitri Devi in his work. And then he stole the culling doctrine from Clausen. I mean, the evidence that the ONA originally in the 60s was a Fed op targeting these type of individuals, and Myatt was a Fed himself, is pretty strong. And I'll tell you what else, there's actually no evidence that the ONA actually was created in the 60s. And I think it's interesting, a thought, many people have speculated this, that that's part of the operation, is that it was created so early, when in reality, the only footprint of the ONA is the, you know, late 2000s footprint with Chloe Stevens and Sutter. And no, obviously it's pre-internet, so there isn't going to be a footprint, and you'd have to actually physically be there in that time to know. But I think it's interesting is that they're claiming that this philosophy has so much historical roots, and it's so attractive to come over to this side because of all the historical depth here. In reality, there may not even be any historical depth. I mean, so if you trace Myatt's movements pre-2000, so in 2000, David Copeland, the nail bomber, gets caught with a copy of Aryan Revolution, Tactics for Aryan Revolution, which is a handbook by David Myatt. A lot of great things in there as it relates to the smiley face killer and the modus operandi. In 2000, Copeland gets caught with that. And then 5 or 6 years later, there's this ONA revival where they're targeting people like Copeland who are lone wolf terrorists, essentially. And if you trace Myatt's movements pre-2000, there's actually no ONA. So if you trace his movements, you'll find he was writing for something called Temple 88, which was like a riff off of David Lane's 88 precepts or something. I don't know too much about that. Nothing to do with the ONA, more Aryan racial purity stuff. And he was also in Combat 18, also nothing to do with the ONA, right? More Aryan racial purity stuff, Aryan guerrilla warfare stuff, Combat 18. And I also found some of his writings and stuff in more occult groups before 2000, unrelated to the ONA, called the White Order of Thule, which obviously is based off the Thulean society. And they have a Wikipedia page as well. But I it's interesting. I mean, Myatt's footprint pre-2000 is in these guerrilla Aryan movements, which is why Copeland had that book with him in 2000, because he was actually interested in those circles. And Myatt was a paragon in those circles. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why they stylized the ONA around Myatt. If the ONA wasn't created in the 60s and was created, you know, in the 2000s, it's obvious why they stylized after Myatt, because he was a paragon. He was obviously a very important figure, a figure so important that Copeland had his novel in his apartment, his handbook on how to win Aryan, Aryan warfare tactics. Like, it's, and a lot of that is applicable to the profile as well. So, and then not only if you trace Myatt's pre-2000 work, but also if you trace where the ONA started to permeate in 2008. So when it was revived or created in 2008, I don't know, it started to permeate Iron March, the website. Does that ring a bell?
No, I'm assuming just judging by the term, it sounds like a neo-Nazi website or something.
It was a very popular neo-Nazi website for Adam Waffen. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where the ONA started to appear and started to permeate. And Iron March was created by an individual named Alisher Mukadimov, who was a Russian national. So there was a little bit of a national security concern there with Iron March. And I believe they created the ONA revival or creation in 2008 to permeate Adam Waffen and Iron March and the movement that was happening there, to basically give people who believed in like extreme forms of negative eugenics and essentially murder an outlet and a place to go and speak to people. And these people would have been Chloe, Stevens, and Sutter, all three who are feds, by the way. I mean, I don't know if your viewers realize this, but the ONA revitalization in 2008 was essentially 100%, in my opinion, a federal op. Allie Winston did some great research on why Sutter himself is a fed or is an asset. Sorry, an asset. I would say an asset. Yeah. Chloe herself, almost certainly an asset, the most fakest individual I've ever seen in my entire life. Like every single thing she wrote in her entire ONA career, right down to the last, thing about being evil or Satan or anything to do with Satanism was completely fake. And you'd have to know who she is in real life, which obviously I can't tell anyone. But and then Stevens himself, you trace all his websites, you trace Stevens' websites back in time, you realize that he also was working on another website called American Nihilist Underground Society, which was started as a black metal review website in the 1995s, but grew into a very popular in the late 2000s, a very popular website for negative eugenics discussion amongst the far right, which is, I believe it was Sutter himself who told me that Stevens was arrested pre-2008. And then the ONA happened where Stevens was like running that op. So I thought that was interesting that Sutter like agreed that Stevens was probably compromised, and what he was doing with the ONA afterwards was almost certainly meant to penetrate certain circles.
Yeah, I'm not saying this is Gladio, but it definitely it sounds like someone describing Gladio to a T. You know what I mean? You did allude to, like, I don't know if it was born and whenever. It's almost as if it was a part of the operation. Yeah, it feels like this is just some aspect of something like Gladio. Anyone who's dug deep into Gladio or read things like Program to Kill or just even thought about the kind of person you would need to carry out operations like Gladio or Phoenix, which are essentially, for the most part, hit squads that do pretty fucked up shit, like, the kind of people you need are going to be a specific type of person, a fucking essentially a psychopath of something, maybe not necessarily the right term for it, but someone willing to kill, willing to do awful things, willing to keep secrets. And what better way to figure that out who those people are to recruit than to do something like this? So, because, I mean, serial killers or people, you know, prone to these sorts of things don't just grow on trees, and they're kind of hard to find. So they are a secretive lot. So this would make
Maya
sense
himself as Maya himself has Gladio connections. I don't know if you knew that. So
Maya, I knew Sutter did. I didn't know Maya had specific.
I didn't know Sutter did. That's news to me. Maybe we'll chat about that afterwards.
I'll have to look into it, because it's not something I can spout off my head. The source.
I'm going to be honest with you. What you're saying has been very commonly speculated amongst people as it relates to McGowan's work. And Gladio and Myatt's connection to Gladio, and basically how that relates to these killings, which essentially you describe them as hit squads. Mm-hmm. I describe it as black operations, right? Where the type of people to actually be able to conduct these type of operations without being seen and to know how to do it is essentially, when you boil it down, black ops and black operations.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I guess we probably should get a little bit back on track. We had a fun little sidebar. I enjoyed that.
There's a reason we went on the sidebar, though, and I'll bring that to the forefront after.
Yeah, it's hard not to listen to this and go, Gladio, 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 09A. Because it is like, these are things that basically describe, I mean, whether they are those things or not, it sounds like someone describing them. So But all right, let's. I don't know if you want to continue on. Well, if you have more to say on the
We'll go to the cases soon. But when you think about it, when you think about the profile we just discussed, you think so. You have somebody, some type of group that was operating in the Midwest circa 1995 onwards. You have groups that utilize cell structures and small autonomous cells to create untraceable acts of violence. You have ideological or religious motivation. You have mission-based killer, right? So the killers are obviously trying to complete some type of goal or mission because there's obviously no physical motive or sexual motive. So they're obviously trying to complete a mission. So they're mission-based killers. There's two tiers, one for mainstream and one for underground. They're hyper-competent and likely have paramilitary training. They have a long history. This was Jack Murphy, long history of murder and violence, right? So the group didn't just start murdering people in 1995. And I think that's a fantastic point he makes, is that whatever group this is, they just transitioned their strategy. They didn't just start deciding, I want to kill people in 1995. They just said, I'm going to change my tactics. I mean, they have a long history of murder. And when you look at everything in that profile, it does lead back to what we were just describing, right? So it's not like we're talking about something so far out of the reach here. And the mm-hmm. thing about Myatt, the reason why the ONA is so relevant is because my theory is that the people who created the ONA or revived the ONA in 2008 knew about these killings. They knew that there was people in these circles that were committing these killings. And that's the reason why the clues existed in the ONA as they did. They were trying to entrap them, honey trap them into contacting the Paragons, Chloe, Steven, Sutter, right? These guys were at the top. They were at the top for a reason, not because they were good at their job, but because they wanted people like the profile, the Adam Woffens of the world, the people who followed, Mason, Tomasi, Pierce, Metzger, these guys who are underground types to contact them, because how else do you capture these guys? You can't exactly find them. They're underground. That's the whole idea. They have to come onto your radar. So I think the ONA talking about it is actually very applicable because they utilized Myatt. They basically used Myatt as a conduit for credibility. They basically said, okay, the ONA has street cred in the industry, in the white supremacist movement now, because it's based on Myatt. Mm-hmm. They basically stole his street cred.
Yeah, and to go back to the profile, something I mentioned earlier, which if you understand ONA's philosophy, or what they proclaim to be their philosophy, the idea I was getting at, if you look at the people, and I do think from my understanding, it seems to shift through the generations, because I know earlier cases, it didn't seem there'd be as much. I believe there are later ones with maybe a woman or two. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but I know also it was generally white dudes. And then later on, it seems like that started to change. That's kind of what I'm alluding to, like the Pax Americana, what you think of when you think of that. And so it's almost this symbolic idea of removing, I guess you could say, quote unquote, good. Not saying that necessarily that means that's good, but like in a stereotypical sense. So they are it's like this idea of duality. And it even applies the eugenics component we mentioned earlier, which is part of their Nazi aesthetic.
Racial purity, yep. And that comes down to mission-based killers, yep. And actually trying to achieve something with what you're doing. I think it's pretty clear that the victims themselves represent like kind of anti National Socialist cause. I mean, mm-hmm. if anyone knows the International Jew by Ford, what was that based on? Sorry.
Oh, I couldn't tell you.
Hold on a second. Oh yeah,
my Nazi knowledge isn't as deep.
I'm just googling it quickly. The Protocols of the Elders of Zion.
Oh, okay, yeah, I should have known that. Yep. All right. Yeah,
so that and the Bhagavad Gita, which are two very important, like kind of aspects. One, Bhagavad Gita, more of the occult Nazism, whereas the International Jew and which was Henry Ford, by the way, and the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which was what the International Jew was based on, both allude to this kind of victim typology of people who are impure and who kind of like who are like the Jewish society, the Jewish organized society, how they utilize drugs and alcohol to control society, to decay it, and how that these individuals essentially represent the ethos of, how Jews control society, how they're able to control society. which I think is a very interesting victim typology connection, and why these type of people would be ideologically hated by the profile.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so any more thoughts on profiles before we get into some of the killings?
No, let's get into some cases, man.
Okay. Yeah. But I do want to, I'm going to list them off real quick just for the audience and just to give these people their due. Cause I mean, I don't, and we're not going to go in depth on all of them, but we have Brian Welzin, Keith Ryan, Matthew Simakis, Jesse Ross, Brad Olson, Trevor Boehm, J. Paul Hill, Philip Patnod, sorry, don't mean to be offensive to the dead. I couldn't pronounce your name. And Harsha Madula. And so those are nine enduring from 2005 to 2012 in the Illinois area. Seems most of them from perusing through them were Chicago, through the Chicago River. Probably over about half of them were, and the other ones were other spots. But yeah, so those are the people we're talking about, and I guess we'll probably go into a few specifics here. But yeah, wherever you want to start.
Sure. Yeah. So as I said, I think that this case is interesting to me, or this cluster is interesting to me because of how it relates to the profile. And we'll get into that kind of at the end, but we can start with the Welzin case. This happened in New Year's Eve on January 1st, Y2K, I believe. Yeah. 2000. So first of all, what catches my attention is there's a lot of New Year's Eve cases. More than there needs to be in like a random subset. So that's a very interesting kind of like something that like snaps out at me that this cluster that follows this guy is going to be interesting because there's a lot of other clusters that have New Year's Eve cases and random accidents don't happen. I mean, you can make the argument that more people are drinking on New Year's, but in essence, random accidents, if they are truly random, don't happen in clusters. They happen more often than not randomly, you know, there may be clusters, there may not, but for there to be so many New Year's cases, it's clear that that's an interesting spot to target for people. So Welzin, went back to his hotel in Chicago after drinking with friends on Y2K. His friends left him near the hotel entrance. And then 2 months later, his body turned up in Lake Michigan. So you're going to realize a very similar theme with a lot of these cases. There was no evidence as to why or how he might have A, gotten to the water, or B, got in the water, or decided, you know, why or how he went in the water. That's like a super common theme with these cases. But there's another interesting thing with this case that I think is probably the most pertinent thing that the investigators caught is that the theory was that Brian traveled 5 blocks to the water.
Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of 5-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Water fell in and drowned. However, the investigators noted that for him to have crossed the 5 blocks, he would have then had to have crossed 8 lanes of highway to get to the water. And
this was after he left his hotel, right? So he got back to his hotel, left
with
it.
His friends.
Yes. So, and so he wants the idea that is being alluded is that he was wandered away from his hotel 5 blocks and somehow ended up in the river, essentially.
5 blocks and then across 8 lanes of highway, and then somehow decided to get in the water and was unable to get out. That's what the official story is. Quite frankly, the official story is that he fell in.
Yeah, no from what I'm reading here, it's actually said he literally was with his friend, and then his friend went to go park a couple blocks away, and then he was gone.
He was gone.
He didn't think anything of it because they were both shit canned. I get it. He probably thought he just went up to the room because he had like something like 5 Long Island iced teas, which those are pretty heavy in alcohol, and this guy wasn't a heavy drinker. So, and I guess he'd already thrown up too. So he was pretty shit canned, but I don't know. When you're that fucked up, you don't generally be like, yeah, let's go wander for 5 blocks. Maybe 100 yards. You might go do something stupid, but you're probably the world's spinning, and you probably at that point, at the end of the night, probably trying to get up to your room and start sobering up a little bit.
You nailed it. Why these cases are worth your attention is because you look at this. So it's incongruent. So they're trying to say that this guy fell into the water accidentally and drowned. But it's incongruent with what actually happened, because the idea is that he was sober enough to walk 5 blocks, cross the highway, get across the highway, get to the water. That's when he lost his sobriety. He became a vegetable the second he got to the water. That's not congruent. Either he's too drunk to get, or he's too drunk and he would have fallen in the water, or he's too drunk and he wouldn't have been able to get there. Mm-hmm. You can't have it both ways. So that's why.
Oh, I lost you there for a second.
Yeah, I'm back. That's why you immediately have to question a case like this, and you have to say, okay, there's no resolution, no evidence or proof ever, even to this day, has ever occurred or been produced to the public as to what happened to this kid. And there's no logical reason why he would have walked down there, and actually it physically would have been very unlikely for him to have even been able to do that. Mm-hmm. But yet he just disappeared. Just like every other case, these kids seemingly disappear off the face of the earth and end up in a location that is almost extremely unlikely for them to be in.
Yeah, this one, from what I'm seeing, there wasn't any sort of surveillance, anything. Like, pretty much he was a ghost once he left that hotel, is how it appears. I guess one other little point, Meg, do you want to bring up? I don't know if this really matters, but reading through it, I guess it was initially reported there was a 15-foot drop somewhere, but then later, I guess there are other people who contest that it wasn't really this crazy 15-foot drop somewhere. So I don't know.
Well, they tried to allege the police to basically clear the case. They tried to allege that the drop by the water was so large that he likely got there and then just stumbled and fell in, which is possible. But given what I just said about the incongruency of him being too drunk, to wander all that distance and then just suddenly become a vegetable or succumb to an accident. Yeah. It doesn't compute, right? It doesn't make sense.
Real quick, I do have one of my patrons in the chat, and I do want to address this. He says, I used to go on random walks when I was wasted. I got lost in the woods at Fort McCoy for about 45 minutes trying to find the barracks. And I get that. I get what you mean. I mean, maybe you're just built different, but I think what you're alluding to is like, you're bored, you get drunk, you go do shit. Now, this was different. This was literally, he had been out for a long night. He had already thrown up. He was fucked up. Like, it was the end of the night, they were back to their hotel.
Extremely vulnerable, right? You have to think about the position this young man is in. He is in the most vulnerable position he will ever be in his entire life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that aside, I'm just getting at for, like, him wandering off at that point. That doesn't, I mean, yeah, you always have that drunk friend who wanders off, but that's usually a phenomenon earlier in the night. This is, like, literally they're back at the hotel. I don't think you're going to, when you're already probably, like, you're at that point where you've been drinking so hard, you're probably starting to feel it like, oh, world's spin a little bit. I need to get up to the room. Typically speaking, that's not when you do the drunk thing of like, let's go explore. And if you do, it's maybe you explore around the parking lot, like, or something like that. Not like I'm going to really fucking disappear. That doesn't seem to be match up, at least not with my, it's been a long time since I've gotten that level of drunk, but that doesn't comport with my experience with alcohol in my life.
Without a trace as well. So disappear without a trace. So there was no physical evidence of a fall. There was no CCTV footage of him by the water. There was no physical witnesses saying, I saw this guy walking by the water, or I saw him near the water. He was last seen blocks and blocks from the water and over an entire highway between him and the water. So it's not only the idea that he wouldn't have wandered, it's the idea that the terrain itself would have been, you know, wouldn't have been made sense for him to go there. Like, that's the common theme with all these cases. It doesn't make any sense for this person to be there at that time.
Yeah, he would have been having to use crosswalks and shit, I would assume.
People would have saw him. He would have been on CCTV footage. If there was an accident, there would have been physical evidence of his shoe, maybe on the ground on this 15-foot drop, you know, his shoe or something, and his hat or something. There's no evidence of a drop. There's no evidence of an accident. There's nothing.
Yeah.
Which is what makes these cases so kind of rare and intriguing.
Yeah. All right. Is there anything else specifically? I think I would want to point out this guy does fit the, I don't have a height or weight on this guy, but I see a picture, and it also points out in the profile that he was an athletic guy. He was a soccer player. I believe he was in college doing well. So he kind of fits that profile that I'm kind of alluding to earlier.
Dean's list, never used drugs, called his mother. So that's what's so interesting about the
profile. Scholarly jock. Yeah.
What's so interesting about the profile of victims is it adds to the fact that they wouldn't have done what they did, right? Mm-hmm. So these aren't kids who are idiots, who are who are not responsible. These are responsible young men who would know more often than not to put themselves in these weird situations. Especially, you would think a guy like this would know that now is not the time to walk all that distance, you know, go over the highway and get into the water. There are people who you can speculate, like, you know, the type of profile. Oh, he was out, you know, he dropped out of college. He was drinking every night. He was a drug addict. He got in many fights before. You know, these are the profiles of somebody who would put themselves in that situation, not the profile that we commonly see with these cases over and over and over again, which is that of an upstanding young individual with a great head on his shoulders.
Mm-hmm. Okay, is there anything more that you feel like is pertinent to touch on, Brian, before we move on to one of the other individuals? I believe we were going to talk about Keith next.
Yeah, so, I mean, I would say Wellsen's a good case just because it's the first case I noted in the cluster, but it's also a New Year's case, which is a very common theme amongst other clusters. Every cluster seemingly has a couple New Year's cases, and it's pretty obvious why that is a great hunting day. People would argue, counter-argue, oh, there's going to be more cases on New Year's because more people are drinking. And I don't disagree with you, but think of it from a perspective of probability as the killer when you're looking for victims. What are the days where there's going to be more victims who are in vulnerable situations, drinking holidays?
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably the only thing I would kind of mention is that the New Year's angle is pretty interesting.
Yeah. And so now we have Keith, who is 6 foot tall, 210 pounds, a big boy. I don't believe it doesn't say whether he was in college or not. He was a bartender. So maybe you could make the case isn't perfectly sit, but just by his figure alone, you'd say this guy is basically the profile. So yeah, maybe he wasn't in school. Maybe he wasn't on all that stuff, but yeah, he just looked the part. He was a broad feller. What do you find pertinent in this one?
Well, Keith is an interesting case because he, I just got to pull it up here. For some reason, the Keith Ryan case on Footprints got taken off. You have to go to the old link. I don't know why that is. That's really coincidental.
Oh, I'm on Footprints right now. That's weird.
No, I got it.
Oh, okay.
If you go to the Keith thing, the Keith case through the sliding case Rolodex, it's not on there. But okay, so Keith is a really interesting case. One of the cases, it kind of starts this cluster of I believe it's eight cases in 7 years. And it starts from 2005. And the reason why it's so interesting is because Gannon himself, the original investigator that we spoke about, the guy who wrote the textbook, actually met with this guy's father when it happened. Keith Ryan's father, Roger Ryan is his father. He's an ex-law enforcement official. Gannon met with him at the time when his kid went missing, and then they were both very vocal about the case being connecting to the others in the kind of phenomenon. But Keith's case is pretty interesting because there was absolutely no water where he was seen. So there was water in the area, but he was seen walking in the completely other direction of any water. So they have, he exits the bar. They have video footage of where he went for about a couple miles after the bar, and then he disappeared. They know his general direction. He was heading in the complete opposite direction of water. Obviously, he was never found in water, but the question is, what happened to him? What's going on with a case like this? I think it's pretty clear that it's evidence of the MO and people using this type of kind of opportunity to hunt for victims. And it's kind of the first case in the cluster, the Illinois cluster, which goes all the way up to Chicago after the Ryan case.
Okay. All right. Anything else pertinent here? There is one little note that I guess is worth, according to his dad, he was an experienced swimmer. Although I guess that kind of is weird because he wasn't actually found in water. He's just missing. But I would, that doesn't necessarily exclude the fact that he could have been disposed of in water and just was never found. I don't know where the, what river he was near or what body of water he was near. But yeah, I mean, stuff can happen to bodies. There's a reason why over the millennia, that's kind of been the stereotype of where you dispose of bodies. Typically people try to like put weights or something, but yeah, I mean, they can just disappear, or he could have put them under, they could have put them underwater. I don't know. But yeah, any other key points you want to talk about with Keith, or is that the,
yeah. So Keith is an, so you have Wells on New Year's in 2000, then you have Keith Ryan starting a new kind of, cluster, even though it's 5 years later, obviously, than the Wells and case. So interestingly enough, the next two cases, Sumacus and Ross, are both almost identical to Wells. And so they're involved kids who are in Chicago exiting their hotels late at night, disappearing. I believe Sumacus was found in water and Jesse Ross was never found. So both of the cases are identical except for the fact, and they're in the same location and they're about a year apart, one in 2005, one in 2006. Sumacus was found in water. Jesse Ross was never found. And those would be the next two cases in the cluster. The Sumacus case is about 6 months after Ryan, and Peoria is about 100, not too far south of Chicago. So it's pretty close to Chicago. So you can see why the Ryan case fits in with kind of these Chicago cases. Yeah.
Okay. And I believe the last one you want to talk about was Harsha Madula. Now this one is kind of what I guess I was getting at. I just looked him up just now. I read through all of these except for a couple of them, and this is one of them. But I'm looking through it right now, and yes, this is kind of what I was alluding to earlier, and that this kind of change. This is looks like an Indian kid. I haven't been able to look over his bio, so you can tell me a little bit more about him. But he kind of looks like a more modern version of the Pax Americana, if you will. I would just judge stereotyping how he looks. He kind of looks like a smart kid, with a bright future, once again, that's just glancing him. He could be a complete idiot for all I know, but it's kind of just first glance. That's the impression I get. But yeah, go on. Did I lose you? Igor? Is that on my end?
Sorry about
that. Oh, you're
good.
Okay. I was like, I thought maybe my internet was glitching out.
I heard you. Madula is interesting because he's the only non-white in the group. I think Paul Hill might be mixed. So obviously Madula is interesting for that reason, but it's also interesting because it was from Evanston, Illinois. So you'll see in the case list, there's also a case from 2008, Trevor Bohm, from Evanston, Illinois. He went missing on campus there. And I believe he went missing at a similar location to Harsha Madula. Mm-hmm. So there was a couple cases there in Evanston. And yeah, the Madula case, as I said, was interesting, not only because he was not white, but also where he was found. So he was found in the Wilmette Harbor. Wilmette's like a very kind of like small village, if you will, above Evanston. That relates to kind of what some of my work relates to, the Wilmette Harbor. And I'll explain that a little bit later.
And by the way, a common theme with these two is these people usually have their wallets and stuff, so it isn't like something like a robbery. I mean, I think there are some exceptions to this, but for the most part, they usually have their valuable possessions with them. I did want to point out, just skimming through this, he was an 18-year-old sophomore at Northwestern University. So I think that kind of comports to what I was talking about. My first glance was correct, I believe. I mean, I would assume he had to have skipped a grade at some point to be an 18-year-old sophomore in college. So he seems to have had his stuff together, a young guy with a bright future. And
definitely a smart kid. This is another thing you noticed about that case that's very smart is he extremely intelligent and fits the profile of the type of kid who would, more often than not, if he had his faculties available to him, probably wouldn't be putting himself in very vulnerable situations, or would have the head on his shoulders to understand what situations are not tenable to him.
And with this guy, he literally sent a text message saying he was going back to his dorm room, coming back from a party, but then there was no sign of him after that. So they have security cameras. I mean, this is a university. There's going to be street cameras. I don't know. I know when I was in college, there were like separate streets where you go to like a, I don't know, some like the fraternity houses or something like that. But even then, those were on pretty big streets that you'd think would have security cameras all over the place, even just on people's residences and stuff. So you would think he would have been picked up somewhere. But I guess now that we've kind of, if you want to cover anything more about Medulla, let me know. But I think now would be, and if you don't, I think it would probably be a good time to kind of cover how these are significant, because I know we talked about this in our first episode, and we talked about all this is because a lot of people see this and just go, well, weird shit happens, accident happens. And sure, it's theoretically possible one of these things in a vacuum could theoretically happen, as unlikely as they are. But now the question begins when they stack up. So I don't know if you want to get into stats and kind of how likely this sort of thing would be. Because, I mean, we can look at stats and kind of be like, this is the typical rate of drownings or whatever the fuck. And are we essentially kind of like, is this something outside the realm of what is statistically normative?
I think you nailed it on the head. So some people, they're skeptical. They read one case and they say, oh, it's likely that this one case, this one person could have, it's in the realm of possibility, could have drowned accidentally. But then you add 50 cases, 100 cases, 20 years of cases, clusters of cases where the victim typology is the same, right? The sex of the victim, the age of the victim, the modus operandi of the killers in terms of how the victim just disappears and is found later in water or just never found again, how they're utilizing the inherent vulnerability of nightlife and people who are involved in nightlife to their advantage, right? They're basically using the fact that these young men are never in a more vulnerable situation, they're never in their lives in a more vulnerable situation than they are in the situations that these young men in all of these cases find themselves in. Drunk, out alone, in the streets, without anybody, out alone, in the streets, drunk, at an odd hour of the night, often cold, often in times where it's negative degrees, you know, a colder months of the year. So there's very little people on the streets to kind of, you know, witness anything. It's almost the perfect time for a serial killer when you think of it, just kind of like, you know, basically.
I totally had forgotten the angle too of it being cold, this being Chicago. At least I know the first one we covered, I forget which, what was that? Well, that was Brian. That was a New Year's thing. So it would have been cold as fuck. And I believe he was the one who wandered off five blocks, or maybe that was Keith. I don't know if
you're right. So that was the first case. And you have to think to yourself, okay, it's goddamn cold in Chicago on New Year's.
I mean, alcohol keeps you a little bit warmer, but not that much.
Yeah. This guy's allegedly in the cold, walked five blocks, then crossed eight lanes of highway, then decided to get in the water and was too much of a vegetable at that point to leave the water. That's what you have to believe there's not human intervention here. And it's almost more wild to believe that, in my opinion, than it is to believe that there's human intervention.
Mm-hmm. All right. Any final takeaways on the Illinois cluster in general? Kind of maybe your reasoning why this is where you started. I know you kind of alluded to that we would kind of get to that point, or just anything in general that you kind of want to cover.
Yeah, we can talk about that for sure. So, I mean, the case, there's 10, I think 10 or 9 cases starting with Wellesen in 2000, ending with Medulla in 2012. You listed the cases to begin with. Your viewers can kind of go off themselves. You Google any of those names, you'll get oodles of news articles to satisfy your curiosity. The reason why this cluster, I think, is so interesting to me as it relates to the profile that kind of all the researchers have kind of like put together and singled, kind of, you know, agreed upon. So clearly the Wellesen case is a little bit of a, this is on a little bit of an island there in 2000. It's clear that there's a serious cluster between Ryan and Medulla being 8 cases in 7 years. The interesting thing about Ryan, so you look at the other cases in the list, a lot of them are Chicago, some of them are Evanston, which is a very big center. And then you have Peoria, which is this small little off-beaten kind of suburb of Chicago. Little kind of, you know, really, I mean, Peoria is like, you know, for there to be just a random case in Peoria, it's kind of strange, right? And I thought about that case. I thought about how Gannon was so vocal, met with that guy's father, Keith Ryan, met with his father, was so vocal about the case being a homicide and connecting to the other cases. And then I realized, it interests me, I realized in Peoria, the exact week that Keith Ryan went missing was the week that Matt Hale, the leader of Creativity, was sentenced to 40 years for conspiring to murder a judge. So Matt Hale, I don't know if you remember from earlier in the video, or if your viewers remember, I told you that Myatt stole the Culling Doctrine from an individual named Ben Klassen, who created kind of this early movement, kind of Aryan racial purity movement called Creativity that got extremely popular around the early 2000s. Ben Klassen actually committed suicide in early 90s. And the person to take over Creativity was a young law student named Matt Hale. So Matt Hale and Creativity were based in Peoria, Illinois. And in 1999, Hale was denied. So this is the year before the cluster even began. Hale was denied his law license from the Bar Society of Illinois. One of his supporters, I don't know if you remember this, Benjamin Nathaniel Smith in 1999, went on a shooting spree throughout Evanston and Chicago, killing multiple Jewish people, targeting, I think, 13 different individuals, killing a couple, a black individual in Evanston, and some Jewish people in Rogers Park, which is a suburb of Chicago. And the reason why he went on that shooting spree is to basically avenge Hale for having his law license denied. So Hale had his law license denied because his white supremacist views didn't comport or weren't, you know, kosher, for lack of a better word, for the Illinois Bar Society. And they said that, you know, he with those views, he's not allowed to become a lawyer. This little adherent, Ben Smith, who was an 18 or 19 year old kid, was so upset by it, he went on a shooting spree and killed a bunch of people. And he's an example of a mission-based kind of killer, which I thought was interesting. So fast forward 4 years. So they basically, Creativity under Hale in Peoria, they essentially martyrized Ben Smith. Ben Smith, sorry, that's his name. Yeah, Benjamin Nathaniel Smith. They martyrized him. They basically made him out to be, you know, a martyr, somebody who did, you know, something fantastic for the cause. And I've spoken to multiple people about this, and they believe the reason, the fact that Hale and Creativity martyred him and made him so, like, you know, they honored him so much in all their works and all their written works and all that stuff, it made them targets for the feds. So the feds, circa 2004, this is 5 years after the Ben Smith shooting, they sent a undercover operative to become his security expert or his security person in charge of his personal security.
Head of security.
And this guy was a Fed operative. He was there trying to entrap him. And he did. He got him saying some stuff about a judge who was giving them troubles in the legal world. And they used that to convict the guy for 40 years. So they convicted him. I'm not giving an opinion on the actual sentence. They convicted him of a thought crime for 40 years. So when you think about how that would affect people and how that makes his adherents feel and how that makes anyone who's associated with him in the movement feel. I mean, I've seen rapists get 10 years. I've seen murderers get 15 years.
Yeah.
40 years, basically the crime he committed. And as I said, I'm not commenting on whether or not the crime, I agreed with it or not, the sentence. But he uttered words to a security expert that could be construed as potential affirmation to murder the judge. And they use those
lines of it'd be really cool if someone would kill that guy type deal.
Correct.
Yeah.
And they use those recordings in trial to convict him. So the arrest itself happened in 2003. The conviction, which was the sentencing, which was the real shocker, right? Because everyone knew he was going to be convicted. Everyone knew he was going to go to jail for a little bit. Nobody knew they were going to throw 40 years at the guy. Literally, you know, essentially kill him, right? I mean, if you spend 40 years in jail, you're coming out when you're 70 years old. As far as I'm concerned, you know, they're killing you by giving you 40 years. This was a huge, huge thing at the time. Hale sentenced 40 years, basically completely breaking up creativity, all of his adherents going in different directions. And this happened the week before the Keith Ryan case. The sentencing happened the week before the Keith Ryan case in Peoria, Illinois. So you have Hale, who I'll get to it in a second, but essentially fits the profile pretty close in terms of where all these profiles lead, his group. And you have a guy like Ben Smith, who fits the profile as well. The week before the Ryan case, the week before this cluster all the way up through Chicago, he was sentenced to 40 years. And then randomly, in this little shit suburb of Chicago, this little nowhere suburb, there's a case. That week, there's a case. A case where there hasn't, like as I said, there hadn't been a lot of cases in Chicago. I had only singled out one before that, the entire time, that kind of, you know, comported to what I believe are applicable cases. And then you have this Keith Ryan case, which started a massive cluster happening in Peoria, the only case to ever happen in Peoria, right? So this is the only case to ever happen at any point in time in Peoria, at like right on this week, where it's clearly a huge week as it relates to the profile, I think is, you know, one of the most underlooked connections possible, or at least currently out there about the Smiley Face killer. And it's interesting, Ben Smith himself, the killer in 1999, the guy who went around and avenged Hale for losing his law license, he was featured in a documentary titled Invisible Revolution the year before he committed the murders. I believe Beverly Patterson did that documentary. And in that documentary, there's screenshots of his journal. And in his journal, shows connections between, like, he shows the creativity symbols right next to the White Order of Thule symbols, showing that Ben Smith himself was interested in not only, like, you know, the more guerrilla radical elements of, you know, white supremacy and the Aryan movement, but also the more occult elements. And then I told you already, you go look at the White Order of Thule circa 1998, they're making missives that feature James Mason and David Myatt.
Yeah, you brought up two words there you said really piqued my ears up. Invisible revolution, because that made me think, like, obviously we alluded to 09A here, and part of their philosophy is things like aeonic change, I believe, which is, or you could call that strategy of tension, order through chaos, I mean, there's other words I can think of. They're describing accelerationism. These are kind of all words saying the similar things with different aspects applied to them, perhaps like different tinges of meaning to them. So I don't know. I find that because I was, as you're saying that, I was kind of like, well, wouldn't these guys want credit? And you're like, but if you have more of a long game view, the idea is just to scare the people. Yeah, you know, kind of, you know, spread discord and kind of create order through chaos, aeonic change, strategy through tension. You know, these similar words accelerate.
You said know, something things, interesting. So, yeah. Wouldn't they want credit? So you have to actually read Mason, read Hunter by Pierce, read Tomasi, and read Beam, and read Myatt, Aryan Revolution, to understand that the credit's not what they're after. They're after being practical and being effective, right? And the way that they believe that they can achieve this effectiveness is through small-scale, untraceable acts of violence, right? Which act to destabilize society slowly and surely and effectively, as opposed to kind of like the McVeigh type of strategy, which is to, you know, do one big attack, you get caught after, and you probably, you know, didn't really, you know, get the bang for your buck in terms of your life and what you probably could have achieved with your actions because you were so out, you were so open and so explosive, for lack of a better, explosive with your actions. Whereas these guys are more covert, more underground. They're extremely concerned with all the feds that are a part of these above ground groups, all the informants, and they purposely, like Mason purposely tells his adherents to avoid those groups. The second you get involved with those groups is the second you get caught. You have to do something by yourself or with very small, close people that you trust to the death. And that's the only successful way to do it. And it has to be untraceable. So I don't think that, I think you're right that they're not concerned with the credit. They're more concerned with effectiveness.
Yes, which is kind of why I was throwing those terms around, because that's a similar thing. And those things were usually subterfuge. Either you wouldn't know who it was, or it was attributed to groups other than the actual group that did it. So similar type concept. But I think, unless there's other thoughts you have, I think we're at a good spot to go ahead and come to a close, and we'll cover another cluster and dig deeper into this in another future episode. If you have any, you can have any final thoughts here, if there's anything else specifically that you want to cover that you didn't get a chance to. Otherwise, let people know where they can find you.
Yeah, okay. I'll just summarize. I mean, from my perspective, you have these profiles. They lead to one specific area. You have this Illinois cluster, which is extremely interesting. Clearly starts a cluster with Keith Ryan. And the Keith Ryan case has a very odd coincidence as it relates to the cluster in terms of what happened in that little weird area. The time that that case happened, it's like a coincidence. Like, to me, it's like a multiple lottery winning type coincidence. And then you have the Ben Smith documentary where it shows that the creativity was associated with the White Order of Thule, which was being, which had publications including Mason and Myatt in the late 90s, showing that these guys in creativity were not only in the kind of like, you know, guerrilla white Aryan white, you know, racial purity movement, but they were also in the more occult elements, which is kind of where my profile was leading towards. And I think that, and what's interesting is that Ben Smith himself is from Wilmette and struck in Evanston. And you see the cluster as it goes up, it ends with Medulla, who was found in the Wilmette Harbor. Wilmette's like this tiny fucking village. The chances that a case like that happens there, it doubles the coincidence of the Ryan case, the Wilmette Harbor case with Medulla, because that's the hometown of Ben Smith, Wilmette. And the Evanston case, the two there, Bohm and Medulla, also interesting because, well, Evanston's right next to Wilmette, sorry. He was found in the Wilmette Harbor. But Evanston's also interesting is because that's where the Ben Smith struck. And that's where he killed one of the basketball coaches from an Evanston university. And there's a yearly race to honor that guy in Evanston. So for there to be cases in Evanston as well, it's almost like, you know, it's tripling of the coincidence as it relates to the Ryan case. And I'm still working on it myself. It kind of tingles my brain to think about that, the odds. That would have to be a coincidence, right? It's so large.
Yeah, and even then, just the odds of, I mean, we have 8 cases over 7 years under these very, very, very specific conditions.
Extremely specific, yeah. And very small geographic location, yeah, as well.
Yes. So most of these in Chicago, but overall in Illinois. So yeah, that seems to be beyond the realm of, I mean, you add it up, it's like, it's a strong pattern. I mean, that's all. I mean, like, sure, theoretically, it's possible, but obviously we're going to cover other clusters. And so when you add this in, it's kind of like at a certain point, this pattern becomes overwhelming.
Your viewers will see that there's similar types of connections I just made with Matt Hale and creativity to the Ryan case as it relates to the Wisconsin clusters and the Michigan clusters and the Pittsburgh clusters. So we can get into that, and maybe I'll give a couple shout outs before we kind of end up here. Mm-hmm. Just in terms of people who are great researchers in this sphere, Bill Ramsey, obviously, mm-hmm, he has done a lot of documentary style videos on these cases. I had done about 3 or 4 years of research on these cases back in 2010 to 2014, stopped working on them, and it was Ramsey's videos that kind of brought me back in. So I would give a shout out to him. Shout out to Jim Smith as well, who's kind of in the space. He does the Twitter account Drowning Smiley Face Cult, I believe is his Twitter handle. He tracks the cases there. And then obviously Jack Murphy, who is the other guy who has made a profile. His profile can be found on SOFREP. You just Google Jack Murphy, Smiley Face Killers. You'll find that on Google. He's a great guy, and he is so knowledgeable. And it's funny how he didn't think he knew much about these cases, but he didn't realize that because there's such a militaristic aspect and a paramilitary aspect to the UNSUB profile, he knows way more than he even kind of could know himself. Nicole Weissensee Egan, she's working kind of with Gannon and Gilbertson. She's trying to be the glue between kind of all the researchers and to get us all to cooperate and get some good work out. And then last but not least, I would say Jeff Shope. This guy, ex-National Socialism leader. Yeah, ring a bell, right?
Yeah. I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole.
I've been speaking with him because I don't have any political affiliations. Okay. And I know you've done some videos on him, which is why I was afraid to mention his name. Quite frankly, he is a resource as it relates to this profile. Exactly. Yeah. Right. I mean, I have nothing else to say. He's a good guy, and he has made some great.
I interviewed David Gletty, the informant, and I the whole time just, yep, okay, tell me more. So, yeah, I mean, if you have information to tell me, okay, doesn't mean I agree with your things you have done or that I buy everything you said. I saw that,
by the way. So,
yeah, because I don't buy everything David Gletty said there either. I mean, I think some of that stuff was embellished or wrong for one reason or another. I can't prove that, obviously, but, I mean, when you're someone who's a paid liar, at some point, it's like, I'm going to take things you say with a grain of salt.
that's a great perspective.
Yeah, as long as you're approaching Shope in that same way, sure.
Well, I would say that Shope has a lot of good knowledge about individuals who are in the movement, mm-hmm, and he also knows a lot about people who are associated with Hale. I just think that he has a good heart, I would say, about Shope. That was my read of him. Like, he has a good heart. Like, he wants to see these cases solved. Yeah. And he would help to see these cases solved, which is, to me, that's all I care about, really. So,
I mean,
and that's about it for the shout outs, I would say.
Yeah. And did you let people know where they can find you at, or did I miss that?
I'm on Twitter. I mean, you can find me at Igor Sarsky on Twitter. I post cases. I've been kind of more in the missing cases, tracking, older missing cases. There's so many cases that are just like this, same cookie cutter, except the victim is never found. And to me, those cases are just super interesting because nobody can claim that the person just drowned and they were drunk and there was an accident, right? There has to be an explanation, and people can't grapple with that when they see how many cases are just missing. They're never found. They can't use that default, they just must have drowned, drunk, whatever. They can't use that, so it kind of like short circuits them. So I post about the missing cases and kind of ONA stuff as well, and that's where they can find me.
Well, awesome. I appreciate your time. We'll definitely have to do this again soon. I'll hit you up after this. But yeah, for those people out there, please like, share, subscribe, comment, all that good stuff. Boost this up in the algos. Help me out. YouTube's not my fan anyways. But yeah, if you do want to support my work as well, you can do that at patreon.com, just noayjose2020. The lowest level is $2. I'll get you early episodes. For example, this, if you're watching this when it comes out publicly, this was already out for a week on the Patreon. So, on the Patreon. So that's up to you guys. Obviously, if you want to support, that's cool. I appreciate it. No pressure. But at the higher end, that's my sponsors. I read them off every episode. That's my co-host on Tower Gang, at Tower Gang Toad. I also have at Abrogate D's and at @ZOVERACK. At _infinite_zeal, then Jacob Daniel of the Biblical Anarchy podcast. You can follow him at Biblical Anarchy. Then Tim Tuttle, the homie, at Jolly on Klebold, where I got a lot of edits from. And then my buddy Will Bell of Blueberry. This blueberry wine is delicious. Rabbit Eye blueberry wine. I highly recommend you get it if that's your thing. If you like the old alcohol, if that's something that sounds good to you, it is delicious. I don't drink alcohol hardly much anymore for reasons. I mean, not necessarily for this. I'm glad I don't drink like I used to because this stuff is like, what the fuck? But yeah, definitely really makes you realize what a destructive fucking habit is, even though I just gave him a plug. But whatever, glass here and there, whatever. It is delicious stuff. You may struggle to only keep it to a glass or two. But yeah, with that, we are out of here. Thanks, everyone. Thanks for my patrons who support this. Make sure to go follow those guys if you want good people. And with that, we are out.